We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time she will choose life, but they can't do it without your help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside them. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR.
Net. We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to be with you on this week of July 4th. Coming up this Saturday is the 250th birthday of America, and I hope you'll be celebrating and rooting on the United States of America and having a very patriotic spirit about you. And we talked a little bit last week. I gave you my opinion of patriotism and how it's a good thing. And you look at the original word there, a lot of good and positivity flows from being a patriot, whether in this land or another land. And we'll talk about that this week as we head into the July 4th celebration. It's an amazing time to be alive, to see 250 years celebrated of this great nation. And to celebrate and to highlight the founding of America, I'm going to read a couple excerpts from this book by Stephen McDowell. Clearly, Stephen and I are friends, and I'm a huge fan, so this is no surprise. But this book I've got here in studio with me, if you're watching on Facebook or over at stream.afa.net, and I've linked to this for Bobby on the show notes, but nonetheless, this book is titled America, a Christian Nation? Examining the Evidence of the Christian Foundation of America by Stephen McDowell. It's a pretty short little booklet, and it's an easy read, I guess is what I'm getting at. But I want to read a few quotes just for today, and I'll do this Wednesday and hopefully maybe one other time this week. But I'm going to read a couple quotes here. So if anyone is doubting the Christian heritage of America and the fact that the Bible and Christianity formed America, let me read a couple quotes here. So this is a quote from John Jay, first Supreme Court Chief Justice. John Jay proclaimed, quote, "Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers. And it is the duty, as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation, to select and prefer Christians for their rulers," end quote. And if you thought that one was a good one, you just keep listening. Chief Justice John Marshall, another Supreme Court Chief Justice, said, quote, "The American population is entirely Christian." And if you're saying that I sound like Stephen McDowell, that's because I spend a lot of time with him. Quote, "The American population is entirely Christian, and with us, Christianity and religion are identified. It would be strange, indeed, if with such a people, our institutions did not presuppose Christianity and did not often refer to it and exhibit relations with it." That was Chief Justice John Marshall, like, hey, paraphrasing, if you guys don't frequently cite the Bible and Christianity, then what are you doing? This is integrated into the very fabric of a nation, of the nation that we are. Let's look at a couple more, and then we'll move into the show content. This is a special kind of highlight that I'm doing to celebrate July 4th and hopefully bring about some type of patriotic spirit within you. This was from the first charter of Virginia, 1606, well before independence, clearly. This was during colonial America, when we were still answering to Britain, if you will. This was in the text, in the third paragraph of the first charter of Virginia colony, 1606. The third paragraph of the charter speaks of their desire, the colonials' desire, to propagate the, quote, Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God, and in time bring the infidels and savages living in those parts to human civility and to a settled and quiet government, end quote. The Mayflower Compact, this is a history you're not going to get maybe in a 2026 history class, with rare exceptions. Lastly, the Mayflower Compact was written by a small group of English separatists seeking religious and civil freedom, who were undertaking the planting of a colony, quote, for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith, end quote. And so that's just a couple excerpts from Stephen McDowell's book, America, a Christian Nation, question mark, examining the evidence of the Christian foundation of America, once again by Stephen McDowell. So we'll keep highlighting some of these excerpts. Very, very powerful stuff here. Very compelling as to the biblical underpinning that is existent in American history. All right, well, let's jump into some of our content. By the way, we're going to be speaking of early American history. We only have about a little more than 10 seats left on our Boston trip coming up in late September. This is the only trip that we have left for this calendar year. Our next trips are going to be Greece and Italy coming up in 27. But for now, the Boston trip, we've got a little over 10 seats left for that trip, where we're going to Boston and visiting a lot of the sites of the early American history. And we're doing that, obviously, during the 250th year of our country. So if you want to check out our Boston trip, which registration is going to close here in just about 2 weeks, you can go over to tours.afa.net, tours.afa.net. We're over 90 registered, and we've got about a dozen seats left for that trip. So go over to tours.afa.net to check that out. Well, the Supreme Court has been busy issuing rulings, and on a variety of subjects, honestly too many to mention here on the program. But one ruling that came out last week that we just didn't have quite time to get to is the Supreme Court ruling on what's called temporary protection status that was issued under the Obama administration to various illegal immigrants. And various courts, lower courts, had prevented President Trump from deporting those that were under this temporary protection status, or TPS status. And these courts were just stonewalling and blocking the president from carrying out illegal deportations of non-citizens. Well, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of President Trump, in favor of the Department of Homeland Security, to carry out deportations for those under this temporary protection status. And one of the key words there is temporary, which is what the Supreme Court concluded. And there was a lot of other good writings in these opinions. But nonetheless, I want to play clip two here. This is about a 30-second clip on Fox News reporting on the rescission of TPS, this temporary protection status, and the eligibility for deportation here. Clip two.
Supreme Court today giving a major boost to President Trump's immigration agenda. The justices ruling 6-3 to allow the White House to remove temporary protected status for hundreds of thousands of migrants from Haiti and Syria. Let's bring in Carrie Urban, Fox News legal editor. Reading from the majority opinion here, it says, in these cases, we consider whether respondents who challenge the termination of temporary protected status, TPS, for aliens from Syria and Haiti are entitled to orders postponing the terminations during litigation. We hold that they are not. To a lot of people, this was a no-brainer because, again, the T in TPS stands for temporary.
Well, there you have it. So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration. Big deal here. And these victories, let's not forget that a lot of this stuff should be assumed. So the fact that we're having to litigate over this in and of itself is very unfortunate. And so for that, you can be pessimistic that we had to litigate this. But nonetheless, the ruling is ultimately a victory for President Trump and for the rule of law and the ability for the federal government to deport non-citizens, to deport illegal immigrants, regardless of what a previous administration might have classified them under various provisions and statutes. Another story on this topic is the story of immigration, whether it be legal or illegal, and this really reformation that has been brought about by the Trump administration. We are seeing some very positive numbers on the immigration front, both legal and illegal. And CNBC took quite a twist on this that is a little bit slanted, but nonetheless, their headline is, Americans are leaving the U.S. in record numbers and spending hundreds to learn how to do it. Well, the underlying data here that was put out by Brookings Institute really points to two things. It points to the mass deportations are having an effect. That's a fact. And Brookings is also conflating illegal and legal immigration, all right? And so, nonetheless, at the end of the day, the data shows, at minimum, a flat net migration. So, for example, just to not get too in the weeds on using net and positive, et cetera, immigration... migration, both to and fro the U.S., was pretty much flat. It was pretty much a break even, if you will. So for every one person that left the country, we had about one person come in, is the easiest way to put it. And that's a very big deal for looking at modern history. Let's just look at the last couple decades. We have persistently every year been adding millions of both legal and illegal immigrants to the country. We've been having at least a million legal immigrants come into the country through the legal system, whether it be work visas or refugee status, et cetera, legitimate asylum claims. And then over here on the other hand, we've had this influx from the border where we haven't been enforcing our immigration laws. We've been allowing hundreds of thousands, over a million in President Biden's case, multi-million per year of illegal immigrants from the border. And so President Trump, the moral of the story here, according to this Brookings report, is that the President Trump's immigration policies are having a very good impact, very effective impact. And this notion, by the way, that we obviously need to stop illegal immigration. Legal immigration needs to be at zero. There's no good case for illegal immigration, even on the business side. And that's been one thing that's just been lingering for a long time as well. Well, people have claimed that the business community is in favor of illegal immigration because they get cheap labor, all right? And regardless of whether that's true or not, I don't really care. That doesn't make it right, all right? So there's no good case for illegal immigration. Zero. There's zero good moral argument for illegal immigration. But let's jump over to the legal immigration side. When you import a million, let's say a million, which has been on average, legal immigrants a year, well, those people got to have jobs. All right? So you have to be careful with the legal immigration side too, which is where the Trump administration is able to actually focus its attention now that it has the border closed, is what is the net effect of legal immigration, and is it positive for the American people and the American worker? And I think legal immigration obviously can be a positive thing for the country, but it has to make sense, all right? And I would argue that in this era of artificial intelligence, and increased productivity, which is a statistical phenomenon or fact that we're seeing with robotics and artificial intelligence, we're able to be much more productive, those that want to be. I think it's unwise to continue at these legal immigration rates that we've been doing for the last 20 years, a million a year. We've got to look at the jobs market and the economy, and you have to ask yourself, if you're running immigration, can these folks find jobs? Can they contribute to American society and the economy? That's a critical question. We'll be back.
America's 250th birthday. It's a great excuse to have some extra cake and ice cream, but we can help your celebration go well beyond that. Show your patriotism with America 250 apparel that will become a memento of this special year. We also have special episodes on AFA Stream to help underscore that America is a Christian nation and help you find God in the Constitution. Find all of this and more in one place. afa.net/topics/250. At the Core podcast are available at afr.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Well, for those listening on live radio, some of you get the podcast later, but for those of you listening right now on live radio, if Ed's New England accent doesn't make you laugh, then you need to check yourself, because I've heard that clip probably 8 times in the last week, and every time I laugh at Ed revitalizing his New England accent.
I don't understand. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, coming from another New Englander. Where were you from, Bobby?
Originally born in the great whaling city of New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Yep.
How far is that from
Boston? About 45 minutes south of Boston.
No, not far.
Toward the Cape. It's at the very base of the Cape.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We go down that way to Plymouth, I believe.
Yep. I went to high school not far from there.
Yeah. And then Quincy's not too far. Quincy must not be too far from.
Yeah, it's closer to Boston.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, so we're going there in late September. And it's I know it gets a bad rap because their politics are uber liberal.
Right. Right.
But it's a beautiful, it's just naturally a beautiful part of the country.
Yeah. The state is gorgeous. And that's the other part of it, too, is Rhode Island, Maine, all the way up through Maine, that rugged, rocky coast, the lobsters and shellfish of all sorts is—it's actually beautiful, beautiful country. But again,
that last year was my first lobster roll.
Oh man, that's living right there, brother.
Yeah, and apparently there's the right way and the wrong way.
That is correct.
Yeah, and we were getting made fun of, the Southerners were, because I think the Southerners started requesting their lobster rolls be heated up, or the lobster maybe. And up there, it's originally supposed to be cold.
Yeah, it's cold. The hot dog buns or rolls themselves are actually, they've got that New England cut. They're not rounded buns. They're actually sliced vertical, if you will, on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Those have to be hot and buttery.
That, yeah. And then I think
with the cold,
this
salad.
Either it was a server or a chef we were talking to said that years ago, the Southerners came up there and they wanted their lobster heated up too, not just the bun. They wanted the lobster heated up. So apparently they've kind of catered to the tourists that request their lobster be heated up. But to your point, naturally the original is supposed to be cold, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah. And they'll heat it up with drawn butter combined and
then they stuff. And they'll know that you're not from there,
yeah.
Right? If you request it heated up,
pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, we'll be there in late September. If you want to join us, go to tours.afa.net, and we will see you in Boston. All right. Well, let's jump back into some of the content I want to get to on today's program. The Supreme Court also released an opinion just this morning regarding mail-in ballots. And this was a case originating out of my home state here in Mississippi, the RNC, Republican National Committee, versus Watson, which is the current Secretary of State. This case had to do with how long after an election do you continue counting ballots? This is assuming that the ballots are postmarked by Election Day. assuming the ballots are postmarked by the Postal Service by Election Day, the question before the court, in essence, there was a lot of legalese here, but in essence, the question was, how long can a state count the ballots after Election Day? Mississippi statute said 5 days. That was being litigated. Let's listen to this report from Fox on the election ruling at the Supreme Court. Clip five.
Breaking news, U.S. Supreme Court, a decision is now in on a challenge led by Republicans to late arriving ballots in elections. Shannon Bream has the ruling. She's got the news and the headline now from the U.S. Supreme Court. Shannon.
All right, guys, this is not a win for Republicans who were challenging this. Mississippi has a state law which allows ballots to be counted, mail-in ballots, after Election Day. If they come in, they're postmarked and meet the state requirements. But it is a 5-4 loss for Republicans. And an interesting cobbling together of who wrote on this. Justice Barrett wrote the opinion. Justice Roberts joined her along with Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. So those five stuck together on this. The dissent comes from Justice Alito. Thomas Gorsuch and Kavanaugh join him. And essentially what the majority said is that these federal statutes setting Election Day don't prescribe or they don't stand in conflict with states that want to say, OK, we have a procedure to count ballots after Election Day.
All right. This is ridiculous. All right. That's my non-lawyer assessment of this ruling. All right. Let's play this out. OK. And this is the frustration. I'm not going to throw Amy Coney Barrett completely under the bus here, okay? She's good she's reliable about 80% of the time, maybe. I want 100% reliability. That's just what I want. And that's what Thomas and Alito give us. That's why they're the best. They give us 100% reliability. You don't have to worry about whether Clarence Thomas is going to go soft, all right? He plays hardball, and he's there to restore the original text and meaning and intent of the U.S. Constitution and rule sanely on the policy disputes before the court. And that's what I appreciate about both Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. But here we have this. Let's talk about the mail-in ballot process more broadly here. Let's not get caught up in the statutory text of the Mississippi law and what the two sides were arguing. Let's just talk broadly about how we should properly look at this. First off, we've gotten way too liberal, not from an ideological standpoint, but from an operational standpoint. We've gotten way too loose, liberal, on this whole voting thing. We have normalized the mail-in, late, absentee, I'm going on vacation, can I come up there early and do it? We have to way too far of a degree accommodated lazy people who just don't want to do the right thing. And we've created exceptions for everything. And what I'm talking about is all these people that just can't show up on Election Day and vote. And I'm not talking about overseas military, members of the military. I'm not talking about homebound people who have medical diagnoses and they're disabled, whatever. I'm not talking about those statistical anomalies that make up a small percentage of eligible voters and the accommodations we make so that they can cast their vote. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about more broadly able-bodied adults that can drive their car up to the voting booth on Election Day and just cast their vote. And this gets me so fired up because our country's gotten so lazy. We've lowered the bar in virtually every category, and now we're kowtowing and catering to people that can't just be responsible adults and show up and vote on Election Day. And let me just tell you, if we broke down, I could almost guarantee it, if we broke down the number of able-bodied adults that can get to the polling place on Election Day and vote, and the ones that and compare them to the ones that are utilizing this mail-in ballot scheme, I would almost bet you the vast majority would skew towards Democrat. The vast majority would skew towards Democrat. Because there's this mentality, this entitlement mentality that the government owes me and you should accommodate me and I'm going through a hardship and woe is me, permanent victimhood. I ought to be able to vote whenever I want to vote, 3 weeks before, 3 weeks late, the government can't tell me when I can and can't vote. I mean, I can just hear the left-wing Marxist talking points being regurgitated right now when they're arguing in favor of these absolutely absurd ballot deadlines. And so the Supreme Court ruled, in my opinion, wrongly here, and they left the door open for ballots being counted indefinitely after Election Day. And so the proper way to look at this, and this is where our country should return to, and I would encourage every single state legislature to heed this, and some already have. At 11:59 p.m. on Election Day, when that clock hits 12 a.m. on the Wednesday after, assuming this is the general election, when the clock hits midnight on the following day after the election, that's it. We're done. We're done counting. We're done mailing. We're done with everything. It's all done. And the reason I say that is because we can accommodate everything we need to accommodate before. And I think we need to be less accommodating. But I think we need to accommodate everything we need to accommodate before. All right? If you're forward deployed in the military overseas, all right, let's accommodate that before. If you can't make it because of a legitimate medical reason, or if you want to extend that to death in the family, et cetera, although I would be very hesitant to continue expanding this who's eligible to vote by mail. I think it should be very tight. It should be non-inclusive. But whatever the excuse is, valid or invalid, lazy or not, all of that should be handled on the front end. If you can't vote on Election Day at your polling location, you got to do it before. And you can't wait and mail in your ballot the day before the election. Too bad, so sad. It's not getting counted. And if it doesn't make it, whenever you mail it, if it doesn't make it to the county clerk to be counted by Election Day, too bad. Your fault or not. If it's the Postal Service's fault, then you can take that up with the Inspector General and with the U.S. Postal Service. By the way, good luck with that. But there are inherent risks with voting by mail. And if your vote doesn't make it there by 11:59 p.m. on Election Day, too bad, so sad. That should be the policy. That should be the policy. And if people are uncomfortable with that, then we should prioritize our lives to make sure we can vote on Election Day. All right, so if we can take what I just said and we can summarize that and turn it into a state statute, that should be the policy. And this is where the Supreme Court failed to intervene here and set any type of minimum standard for how long after an election we count ballots. And I would almost guarantee you, if you look at the people who are doing this absentee mail-in voting, especially in these Democrat states, I would almost guarantee you a lot of these, quote, excuses are probably just not very serious. This is not very serious stuff. The number of people that have legitimate medical, death in the family reasons, I would bet these numbers are few and far between. What we're dealing with is largely people who don't want to have to go to the polling place and wait in line. I get it. It's an inconvenience. But you know what else is an inconvenience? Paying my taxes is inconvenient. Hiring somebody to do my tax return is an inconvenience. Going to the DMV and waiting in line for 2 hours with a bunch of incompetent people to get my driver's license because I've got to have a piece of plastic to drive my own vehicle. All of these things are inconvenient aspects of American life, although in the grand scheme of life, they're really not that big of a deal. And I'm not much to complain. But my point is that some things you just got to tough it up. You just got to be an adult. And whether it's getting your driver's license, paying your taxes, or voting, these are just parts of life that you just have to do. If you care about it enough, then you'll do what you have to do to vote. And if that means going on vacation the day after the election or coming home a day early to make sure you can vote on election day, you just do what you got to do. And that should be the policy across the board in all these states, and just cut out the nonsense. But let me just tell you why many states, and once again, some have done really good state, updated their state laws on election code. Georgia, even Mississippi, Texas, a lot of these states, probably at least half of them, have updated their election code and have gotten a lot better at this. Florida is the prime example of how to do it. I mean, Florida is so efficient, so secure. It's a beautiful thing. So if you want to look at, hey, how are we supposed to do this? Go to Florida and do what they do. All right, they have everything counted by 10 p.m. on election night across the entire state. One of the, I think, top three or four largest states in the country, Florida. They have everything counted and turned in, results posted by 10, 11 p.m. East Coast time. It's phenomenal what Governor DeSantis has done there. But nonetheless, the reason I believe that states don't want to fix this, and I think Mississippi's probably going to go back to the drawing board on this, I would suspect. The reason I believe some states don't want to fix this is because it leaves the door open. Not only statistically speaking are the majority of people using these mail-in ballot schemes probably Democrat, I would suspect, and there's probably studies out there. But furthermore, I think that Democrat elected officials know, and the Democrat Party more broadly knows, that this helps them. This laxed, mail it when you want to mail it, we'll count it a week after. This laxed election voting mail-in ballot regimen, I believe, only helps the Democrats. It only helps the Democrats because we've seen these elections where, you go to Fulton County and it's election night and things aren't looking so good for the Democrats. And then all of a sudden, somebody finds a tray back in the closet. Oh, but man, we found 10,000 ballots. Man, we're just going to have to count until tomorrow. We'll be here for the next 3 days counting and we'll let you know the results like next week. That helps the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats are proven to have very low standards, to put this nicely, when it comes to election integrity. I mean, very low standards. They're very resistant to reform, to accountability, to doing things better. And it's ripe for fraud. And when you look at the number of election officials that have been arrested by the DOJ or local state officials on election fraud, it's most all Democrat. Look at Philadelphia. Every election cycle, somebody gets arrested because they're running some ballot scheme that's illegal. So this is a Democrat-favored policy. We'll be back in a few. In many ways, abortion was on the ballot this past election, and there's reason for concern. There are many counties, cities, and states who have radicalized abortion, and thousands of tiny babies will continue to lose their lives every day. Which is why the Ministry of Preborn is on the front lines for at-risk babies and mothers with unplanned pregnancies. Preborn sponsors clinics positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country by providing them with resources that they need to rescue babies. Preborn continues to expand their life-affirming care. Their end-of-year goal is to equip 10 more clinics with ultrasound machines. These life-saving machines cost $15,000 each, more than most clinics can afford. When a woman meets her baby on ultrasound, she is twice as likely to choose life. And when she comes to a preborn clinic, she will also be embraced with God's love. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and now through a match, your gift is doubled. How many babies can you save? Please donate. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say the keyword baby, or you can go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the Core here on American Family Radio. Last segment now underway on this week of July 4th, with the 250th falling on this upcoming Saturday. And we hope you'll be celebrating it with many other Americans and finding ways to look back on American history and the ways that God has used this nation to be a force for good and primarily to propagate the gospel of Jesus Christ to the ends of the earth. On with us now is our good friend John Stemberger out of Florida. He is now heading up Liberty Council Action. He's president of Liberty Council Action, the 501c4 of Liberty Council, and he's with us now to talk about some of the work they're doing. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Walker, it's great to be with you again.
Well, John, your associate, Summer, she and I were emailing back and forth on the work you guys are doing at Liberty Council Action to educate voters on the ballot initiative process and some of the important ballot amendments or initiatives that are going on around the country coming up this midterm cycle in November. And so I thought I'd have you on to highlight that because, and this is probably one of the reasons you did this project, is there's so many amendments and initiatives going on. As a voter, it's kind of hard to keep up. So give us a little backgrounder on what you guys are doing on this front.
Well, we have been fortunate enough to be tracking and working directly with people on the ground in about 10 states where they have about 12 amendments that'll be on the ballot in 2026. We hear a lot about the high-profile things. Many years ago, we had the marriage amendments. Similar things are happening now. Both good and bad amendments are on the ballot. They're kind of going under the radar, so we're trying to alert voters to them. So I'm just going to go down state by state. I'm going to emphasize some states that have more important and strategic amendments. But for instance, in Arizona, there's actually the amendments come in two groups. One is life-related. In other words, either trying to establish abortion rights in constitutions or attempting to roll back abortion rights. And then secondly, gender-related things. So protecting girls' sports, protecting children from irreversible sex change surgeries and transgender surgeries. So these are the kind of two general categories that they fall under. In Arizona, there will be on the ballot for sure a protect girls' sports statutory amendment. Some of these are constitutional amendments. Some are just statutory schemes. Not every state has this. But in some states, the people can actually enact a piece of legislation, and it goes into the statutory scheme. In Colorado, they have two ballot measures. They'll go on into the Constitution, and it's to protect children from, again, sex changes and transgender surgeries, and also to protect women's sports. And we're very pleased about those in Colorado. As you know, that's a very blue state. They don't get a lot of action. So this is going to be really good for those people to actually make a difference, hearing from the grassroots and not the legislator that's kind of ramming things through. We dodged a bullet in Hawaii. They had a really bad abortion-related amendment, but that failed. So we were able to dodge that. Idaho has a very important amendment that's a statutory it's a pro-abortion amendment, trying to make abortion a fundamental right in the statutory scheme. And the Idaho Family Policy Center there, Blaine Canzati and others are fighting that vigorously along with Right to Life of Idaho. In Maine, there was a good amendment, a Protects Girls Sports statutory amendment, but the Secretary of State just ruled against it. They have a very hostile government and kind of deep state there in Maine. And so that will not be on the ballot. And that's unfortunate. Now, Missouri has one of the most significant sets of amendments. Last election cycle, Missouri passed a horrible, very pro-abortion amendment. And it was one of the most significant ones in the country. And of course, Missouri is this Christian conservative country. We're all kind of scratching our heads like, what in the world happened in Missouri? So this amendment will actually come back, Amendment 3 in Missouri. We want voters in Missouri to vote yes on Amendment 3, but it's going to basically repeal, for the first time ever, we'll be able to repeal, if it passes, we'll be able to repeal an existing abortion right that was put into the Constitution previously. In addition, it also talks about gender, so it bans transgender surgeries. So that's the beauty of that. It's wider than just the life issue. And so we're very pleased. The governor is very involved with that amendment. He's actively engaged. He's appointed Tim Dury of the Dury Hotels to be engaged as the chairman for fundraising purposes and others. And we have been working in coalition with all these states, but Missouri is a very strategic amendment. If that passes, it'll be the first time ever that a abortion right that was previously put into a constitution has been rolled back. Hmm. Now, they have a very red state. They have a great legislature. This is not a citizen's initiative. This actually came from a very conservative Republican legislature, which is great. Many states don't have that luxury, but Missouri did, and that's going to be definitely on the ballot in November 2026. So we need voters in Missouri to vote yes on Amendment 3 to roll back the pro-abortion rights that were put in the Constitution, and also to establish that minors will not undergo transgender surgeries.
Hmm. John, sorry to interrupt, right. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this overall trend here, because and we're going to link to this to your guys' website so folks can scroll through all this detailed information that you've put together, and the links to some of the state groups that are working on this as well. But nonetheless, the left seemed to have gained a lot of momentum, I would say, over the last, let's say, 2 to 3 years on this ballot initiative front, meaning they were throwing out these ballot initiatives left and right, and conservatives were having a fight on multiple fronts to prevent them. Unfortunately, you mentioned Missouri. Some of these ended up passing. I think Kansas had a horrendous ballot initiative pass. But where does it look like the momentum is now? Because I am hearing a lot of these are very positive amendments, meaning if they are approved, they're very conservative ballot initiatives. So where do you feel like the conservatives have kind of recaptured this, or we're halfway through recapturing it? Where is the momentum now?
Yeah, so historically, as you know, almost every state that has attempted to put an abortion right in its constitution has been successful, except 2 years ago, Florida, Nevada, and South Dakota was able to defeat their amendments, which was great. That was the first time ever that a state was able to do that. But the pro-abortion movement is going after the low-hanging fruit of the very blue states and trying to establish these abortion rights to undercut the legislator or the people's ability to actually change these things. But yeah, it's a very great development that there's these pro fairness for girls sports constitutional amendments, and also banning transgender surgery. These are very popular issues amongst Joe Lunchbucket, amongst ordinary people, even in blue states. So this is a great way to get a win. It also drives voter turnout for our side and suppresses somewhat to the other side as well. So I think that these are great developments, and this is a trend we're seeing now. For the first time, we're seeing good quality amendments instead of bad amendments go up on the ballot.
Yeah, this is encouraging to recapture this process, if you will. And even when this process works out in our favor, meaning good conservative policies or constitutional amendments get put into place because of this process, generally speaking, it does make me a little nervous when you don't need, for example, like 60 or two-thirds of voters to approve, when you need, I think in some of these states, it's just 50 plus 1% of voters to approve one of these amendments. Now, granted, the process to get on the ballot in and of itself is pretty strenuous. But nonetheless, this almost somewhat pure democracy, if you will, that we're flirting with here, I think long-term is rather dangerous because you get a state, let's just say, for example, you get a state like Georgia, maybe, that has a massive metropolitan area in Fulton County in Atlanta. You can, and then you have enough left-wing money poured into the state, you can get a generally conservative state with a conservative legislature and governor to approve some crazy ballot amendments with enough money and public pressure and misinformation. So I'm still open to reforming this process in states that, for example, still have 51% as the threshold to approve these.
Yeah, you make very good points. In the vast majority of states that do have these amendments by statute, by legislative enactment or by citizens initiative, the vast majority of them are 50% plus one. There's a small handful of states, including Florida, that has 60% or some kind of a multiple election process that requires over 50% or a supermajority of some type. That is not the minority. That is the minority position on most of those. The big concern, and I will say this, from a structural standpoint, the Constitution is the place for direct democracy because it's the people theoretically binding the hands of the government. Hmm. You know, the law rules the rulers. That's what a republic is. It distinguishes it from a direct democracy where people are enacting laws. And so this is the proper place. The problem is the Constitution should be for fundamental rights, structure of government, and major structural things. But you got states like Florida that we got off. Bans on fishing nets. We got all kinds of policy issues stuffed in our Constitution. And you've got George Soros and the big money left coming in and just pumping these amendments, manipulating people through ads and all this stuff. And so that's the real challenge. And it is a trade-off.
Yeah.
Because you want people to direct their republic. That's the nature of what it is. But at the same time, the money is just corrupting the whole thing. I think you're right. A supermajority is the best way to look at this, because if you're going to amend the Constitution, it can't be a simple majority. It should be a supermajority.
Yeah. And Florida is the model. And I bragged on you guys earlier in the show because we were talking about counting votes and getting things reported in on election day, election night, instead of 3 weeks later, like they're doing in California. And so, yeah, the 60% to me is a very wise thing to do when you are talking about something as serious as amending the Constitution of the state. I mean, can you imagine if we only needed 51% to amend the U.S. Constitution? Who knows if we'd even be able to get that done. But nonetheless, it would be a much easier thing than two-thirds, and then you got to get it ratified by the states, et cetera. So pretty serious process. Hey, John, tell our folks your website, how they can read more about your work.
Sure, lcaction.org. That's lcaction.org. We are the 501c4 policy and politics arm of Liberty Counsel, which is the flagship organization of Liberty Counsel Ministries that does First Amendment litigation. But there you can find the rest of the states. Do we have time to talk about one other state?
We've got about 3 minutes, so go ahead.
Great. So Virginia is very, very important. Virginia probably has the biggest battle other than Missouri. They actually have two. They have a pro-abortion rights amendment, and then they also have a same-sex marriage amendment. Now, unfortunately, the left is just ganging up on our people on the ground in Virginia, pouring money into this thing, manipulating the messaging, lying about the messaging. And unfortunately, their best messaging, which is all a bunch of lies, when they lie like that, it defeats our best messaging because we're telling the truth. But there is a vigorous fight by a number of pro-life groups in Virginia to defeat the pro-abortion amendment. The same-sex marriage amendment is really not doing much at all. Now, Liberty Counsel, which is the legal arm of Liberty Counsel, the flagship organization, has filed a challenge to that amendment because they did not follow the proper procedures that are outlined by the Constitution. They try to bypass all of that. We've drawn a very good judge who's very fair, very textualist, and so that's in the process of being challenged by our organization. So we're very hopeful that it's possible the entire amendment could get thrown out because they did not follow the proper constitutional procedure to get it on the ballot to begin with.
That would be very, very encouraging. And that's why we're thankful to have legal groups like Liberty Counsel that can take these things to court. And that's one area, John, I know you know the history here as long as you've been in this fight, but the right and the conservative movement has really well-equipped legal organizations, whether it's Liberty Counsel or others, to fight these fights that maybe 30 to 40 years ago we just didn't have the number of legal organizations that can litigate most of the time pro bono to get some of these good things either taken off or added on or fought back, et cetera. Hey, John, thanks so much for coming on the program. We'll send folks and we'll link over to your website so they can check out these initiative summaries.
Great. God bless you, Walker. Take care.
All right. Thanks so much. That's John Stemberger, president of Liberty Counsel Action, the 501c4 affiliate of Liberty Counsel, headed up by Matt Staver, our good friend Matt Staver. So appreciate their work on that front. And in our show notes, we'll actually link to that ballot initiative page. They've got a pretty easy-to-read table of all these different states and the status of these ballot initiatives. And so right now we're looking at, we were looking at 20 possible ballot initiatives across 13 states. This was several months ago. Thankfully, that has narrowed down to about seven states and nine initiatives. So a couple of those states have more than one. Seven states, nine initiatives on this summary page, and we'll link to that. And also, we'll highlight at some point in the next month or two before the election what iVoter Guide is doing, because they've got research and evaluations on these initiatives that they'll be providing for voters in these states as well. We appreciate the work of Liberty Council and Liberty Council Action, and we appreciate John coming on. As a quick reminder, you can subscribe to the show podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in At the Core, click the subscribe or the follow button in your podcast library, and we'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.